Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, May 25th, episode 2. Had a little bit of a break, but we'll see if I can keep reading, keep up the momentum. This article's by David Adam. A weird illusion makes you think objects are lighter than nothing. Do try this at home. It can be an impossible physical experience similar to an optical illusion. Take 3 empty matchboxes, fill one with something heavy, now lift the weighted box on its own. Then put it down, and next lift all 3 boxes together, and you won't believe your brain. In tests carried out by Isabel Wan and her colleagues at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland, on 30 students were there. 90% of those who tried this said the individual weighted box felt heavier than all 3 together. That doesn't make sense. That does. Oh, okay. So obviously, this is obviously can't be heavier because it includes that. And the students knew it. They told the researcher what they were feeling was wrong and begged to try the experiment again to work out what was going on. In order, the order of lifting made no difference, and the illusion persisted when the volunteers held the boxes suspended from a string. Even stranger, when they held all 3 boxes on their palm and then snatched away the lighter pair, they felt the change as adding weight, not taking it away. Researchers say our brains are being fooled in the same way when we are baffled by an optical. By an optical illusion such as the endless staircases by the Dutch artist Marcus Escher. The impossibility cannot only be seen but felt, they write. The matchbox setup was taken from magicians who have known about the illusion for years. It isn't clear what's going on in the brain, but it's possibly related to a separate illusion where we perceive the smaller of 2 objects of identical weights as heavier, says Daniel Huber of University of Geneva, Switzerland. In that case, expecting the small object to be lighter, the brain appears to overcompensate and register it as heavier than it is, says Huber. Behind Ashton Down Forest, okay, the article is by Adam Vaughan, and Hunting Willow Seeds in the 100-Acre Wood. Winnie the Pooh scoured 100-Acre Wood in search of honey, in A.A. Milne's beloved children tales. In Ashton Forest in Sussex, UK, the wood's real-life inspiration, Alice Hudson and Ian Willey are looking for something less sweet but equally vital. The researchers from the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew are seeking willow seeds to deposit in an underground vault. The plan is to reserve them as insurance policy against future threats. Quote, "We don't know what's going to happen," says Wiley. More than 12.5 million seeds have been collected and banked in Kew's National Tree Seed Project, UKNTSP, since 2013 to preserve the genetic diversity for the long term. Willow is a tricky customer when it comes to seed banking, which is why Hudson and Willow's field trip is one of the first of its kind. As cattle graze nearby, Willie spots the yellow catkin of creeping yellow, Sussex repens, a shrubby tea that spreads across the ground. There's just one problem. The seeds have gone. This is one of the reasons why banking willow seeds can be challenging. There's a brief window of opportunity, usually just a few days in April or May, to grab them before they're carried off by the wind. The difficulty is you blink and you miss it, says Wiley. Fortunately, nearby willow clumps hold the telltale white fluff, a sign of seed that will soon be spread. Another issue is identifying willow species correctly can be difficult even for experts like Wheely and Hudson. The trees are known to hybridize, for example, between the goat willow, the Sussex capra, and the grey willow, the Sussex cinerea. However, S. repens is relatively easy to spot because it's the only willow with such creeping growth form and shrub-like height. Paper bags soon fill with seeds, starting the race to get them back to the seed bank. If the seeds aren't safely stowed within a fortnight, they won't be viable. Most arrive at the Millennium Seed Bank, also in Sussex, by post, while today's are driven over by Wiley and Hudson. Inside the bank, the seeds are dried and cleaned. Half are then stored at -20 degrees Celsius, and the rest are cryopreserved in liquid nitrogen. The former allows easy access to the seeds, while the latter is better for long-term storage. Not all species are suitable for banking. Conventional storage only works with seeds if they can tolerate drying, and not all native UK trees species can. There is an issue of trying to replicate the genetic diversity that is found in the wild, but the UK NTSP seemed to be managing that. One study found the bank had 86% of the alleles of the, which is the groups of genes which provide a trait. An allele is a group of genes which provide a trait, which is sort of big or small or things. Other wild variants present in the wild ewe, for example. And what about bringing the seeds out of storage back to life? Quote, we're confident in our ability to germinate them once they come out of cryo or the bank, says Hudson. Should disaster befall the UK scraping willow, it could be a seed collected today that ensures the forest that will be inspired Milne's fiction lives on. Okay, continue to read it. UK blood inquiry, here's evidence. Claire Wilson. Could action have been taken sooner to prevent HIV infections? When Andy Evans was 12, his mother told him he had been infected by HIV. Quote, do you know what that means, she asked. Well, yes, he replied. It eventually kills you. More than 30 years later, Evan gave evidence this month into a UK public inquiry into how HIV was passed to people receiving blood transfusions for certain medical treatments in the 70s and 80s. Evans is one of about 1,200 people with haemophilia, a blood clotting disorder, who became infected with HIV this way. Several thousands also contracted hepatitis C, another blood-borne virus, at the time was fatal. Campaign groups such as the Haemophilia Society and Tainted Blood, an organisation set up by Evans, this is the same person, okay, argue that neither those treated nor their families were told about the risks as early as they could have been. The inquiry set up in the UK government ministers in response to the campaigners' request seeks to establish when doctors and officials became aware of the risks of the treatments and if any action could have prevented many of the people becoming infected. Evan's father learned of the possible danger in 1983 from an article in New Scientist below. It is almost unbelievable that he found out through the national news rather than the trusted physicians, says Evans. At a subsequent meeting with the doctors, Evan's mother asked if there was a risk. A doctor told her there was more a chance of her son becoming debilitated by arthritis, though not having a treatment of injections, than developing AIDS. But at the time, any blood transfusion could potentially have been harboring HIV. Injections to people with haemophilia carried an even higher risk because the treatments were made by concentrating the clotting factors from the blood of up to 40,000 people. It was only one of them had the virus, then the whole batch was contaminated. Safer, heat-treated products were available in the UK by 1984, but some people with haemophilia continued to receive the ultrascot until 1985. Even before then, lives could have been saved if the clotting factors had been given only when strictly necessary to prevent bleeding to death. Evans nearly died from AIDS in his teens, but his health improved when new antiviral medicines became available in the 1990s. Antiviral therapies now mean that many people with HIV can have near-normal lifespans, and hepatitis C is curable. Yet, these drugs came too late for the 3,000 people with haemophilia who died in AIDS and hepatitis C. Quote, the contaminated blood scandal was a tragedy that should never have happened and has caused unimaginable pain and hurt for victims and their families for decades. The UK Prime Minister Theresa May said in a statement before the inquiry began, quote, today we will begin a journey which will be dedicated to getting to the truth of what happened and in delivering justice to everyone involved. The same day, the UK government also announced more money for England's inflicted blood support scheme, which makes annual payments to those who are affected. The Haemophilia Society is unhappy with certain payments to bereaved spouses will still be means tested. People should get compensation automatically rather than having to apply for it cap in hand, the body said, said in a statement. Evans says there's been two scandals, all the infections that could have been prevented and the subsequent treatment of those affected. It makes me quite angry, he says. Okay. This is the evolution section. Ancient pollen reveals the high origins of cannabis. That is the high altitude, I assume. Colin Barris. Where cannabis comes from has been a bit of a mystery, but analysis of the ancient pollen suggests it evolved some 3 kilometres above sea level in the Tibetan plateau, not far from a site visited by Denisonian tussins. Humans began exploiting cannabis early in prehistory. Its seed was a good source of protein, while fibres from its stems can be spun into yarn and made into textiles. All the flowers are sources of cannabinoids, which have been used for a drug for perhaps at least 2,700 years. So this is like 700 years before Christ, not really much. John McPartland, the University of Vermont, and his colleagues have searched through the scientific sources to pick out the prehistoric sites across ages where cannabis pollens have been found. Identifying cannabis pollen isn't easy because it looks identical to pollens from common hops, a close relative. But the team believes it possible to work out the species of pollens by considering the other pollen present at the archaeological site. This is because wild cannabis lives in the open grassy steppes, so its pollen usually occurs with the pollen of steppe plants. The common hop, however, grows mostly in woodlands, so the pollen typically occurs with tree pollen. Applying this rationale, the team conclude that cannabis probably emerged in the Tibet Plateau near Qinghe Lake, China, about 3,200 metres above sea level. So the old sites have either hops or stuff. So that's 3,200 is 2,700. Okay. It may have evolved there about 28 million years ago, which is when biologists estimate cannabis and the common hop last shared a common ancestor. The formation of the Tibetan Plateau helped spread the arid steppe-like environments in which cannabis thrives. The plateau formed when the Indian and Asian landmasses collided. In a sense, we can thank plate tectonics for the evolution of cannabis, says McPlatland. Quote, most people agree cannabis came from somewhere in Central Asia, says Robert Clark, a bioagronomics group at Los Angeles. But he sees limitations in the approach the team used. For instance, the trees may grow on the bank of a river in the steppe environment, so cannabis and tree pollen can co-occur. Qinghe Lake lies just a few hundred kilometers northwest of Brasher Cave, which we know now is visited by Denisonians at least 160,000 years ago. So let me try and work this out. Okay, but James Jacques Chaplin at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, Germany, notes that the Earth was in deep glaciation at 16,000 years ago. We don't yet know whether cannabis continued to grow in the Tibetan Plateau during such punishing conditions. However, the Denisonians may have encountered the plants elsewhere. Cannabis pollen has been found in Denisonian cave in Russia, where Denisonian fossils were first identified. It's just really weird to even bother about it. Sea otters bounce back into the jaws of the great whites by Jake Bulcher. Decades of conservation works have boosted sea otter populations in many parts of the North Pacific Ocean, but the animals are now being killed by great white sharks. The sharks prefer blubbery, calorie-dense prey like seals, so any bites on furry sea otters are probably mistakes. But these bites often cause fatal injuries, leading to an increasing number of otters washing up on California's beaches. With, obviously, I hope, shark bites in them. Jerry Moxley at Monterey Bay Aquarium in California and his colleagues set out to investigate where and when these bites, are happening. Comparing the data on sharks' movements and otter standings, they found that the sea otters were being bitten more frequently in summer. Around the time the adult sharks, some come closer to the shore before heading to the seal rookeries. Trying to work out what's happening there. The team thinks sharks, which are low on fat reserves after a long migration, come to less discriminating towards the seal-shaped animals they find. The researcher also found that it was mostly the young male otters that were bitten. Quote, "The males and younger otters are more likely to venture into new territory," said Moxley. Oh, sorry. Maybe they're not. They're by themselves finding mates, so they're by themselves rather than a group. This makes it harder for the species to reestablish itself in areas it once thrived. Oh dear, I find that a bit unlikely. Okay. Chinese rover unearths moon's deeper secrets. By Leah Crane. There's a pretty interesting picture here, especially the moon, a very, very chocolatey brown moon. It's like the moon is made out of chocolate in this picture. So not the colour I'm used to the moon. The moon's mostly grey. This looks like Mars. We're peeking under the crust of the moon for the first time. China's Yutu rover, which arrived January, and the Chang'e 4 lander has spotted what seems to be a primitive material of the moon's mantle. This may help reveal details about our satellite's early magma ocean. Chang'e 4 landed on the far side of the moon in a crater known as the South Pole Atkin Basin, which is 2,500 kilometers wide. Computer simulations have shown that the impact made this feature was probably powerful enough to punch through the moon's outer crust, revealing rocks from the interior. Chun Lai Li at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing and his colleagues examined the data that the Yutu-2, which is different, rover. The lander may have had the rover. So, like, the Yutu-2 may have the rover. But why would you call it 2? I don't know. No. The UT2 rover is on the lander, so I don't understand why he caught two. They seem to have found an area of material tossed from another smaller crater into the basin. Crucially, the soil I think means erosion. I don't know whether the moon has soil, as far as we know, but crucially, the soil that UT2 examined contained relatively heavy minerals such. Minerals rich in iron, such as and magnesium. So, our core of our Earth is iron and magnesium. Early in the Moon's history, when it was covered with the magma ocean, these minerals would have sunk while the lighter silicates floated and later solidified in the crust. That's okay. Yeah, I'm allowed that. This is the first ground truth of what the interior of the moon is really made of, says Bronnie Hogan of Purdue University in Indiana. Quote, "I would say the really important thing is that it's different from Earth. This difference may be because how water changed the Earth's mantle in the Earth history," she says. The ultimate goal is to decipher the mystery of the lunar mantle and composition. So core, I'd say. The mantle is the thing with crust and core. Whether you could say the moon has a crust is another question. This is all mantle. Okay, by Michael LaPlage. Hearing aids pick out the right voice in a crowd. Sometimes it's hard to make out what people are saying in a noisy crowd. Hearing devices that read your mind to work out which voice to amplify may help. Oh dear. A prototype can separate two or three different voices of equal loudness in real time, and then work out which voice someone is trying to listen to from their brainwaves. Developed by Nima Mesgrani of Columbia University in New York, it is a step towards hearing aids that solve a classical cocktail party problem, how to separate voices from a crowd. First, Mesgrani and his team worked a system that could separate voices of two or three people speaking in the same loudness. Next, they played recordings up to three voices reading a story to three people who had electrodes in their brains to monitor their epilepsy. Oh, well, you may as well do that. In 2012, Magrani showed that the brain waves of certain parts of the auditory cortex can reveal which of several voices a person is focusing on. By monitoring the brain waves of the volunteers, the devices could tell which voice they were listening to selectively identify it. When the volunteers were asked to switch attention to a different voice, the device could detect the shift and respond. A practical hearing aid is still a way off. You can imagine that. You don't have to have epilepsy for this device. You can imagine. For starters, people won't want electrodes in their head, but MicroSense says it's possible to detect relevant brain waves from scalp electrodes or even electrodes built into earphones. The hearing aid would also be able to cope with more than three voices of other kinds of noise. This should be achievable, for instance, more distant voices at a party together into a babble noise that is simple to filter out. Oh, darn. Live fast, die young, problem for forests. I can imagine, I think this would probably be, this is by Adam Vaughan. I suppose this is the problem that people want carbon abatement. And so they're interested in the carbon thing, and so they build it, let's grow a tree, and it grows in 20 years, and rather than, you know, hundreds of years. Planting trees is often hailed as a way to counter global warming, but the future of this strategy could become less effective. What you really need to build, grow, is plant a variety of trees, I would say. In a warmer world, with rising levels of carbon dioxide in the air, researchers think trees will grow faster. But this isn't necessarily a good thing. Faster growth may mean shorter tree life, reducing the amount of time they lock carbon away. A study adds that evidence for that this is the case. Oft Bundgen of the University of Cambridge and his colleagues looked at the tree ring records going back 2,000 years and found that the longest lived trees are those in the slowest growth rate. Yeah. The team studied 1,800 trees, all mountain pines from the Spanish Pyrenees to the Iberian Larch, from the Russian Altai region, which can live up to 800 years. But in the warmer world, with more CO2, these trees might live just 150 years after growing rapidly, which would keep we should keep planting trees to tackle climate change, says Bulton, but we should realise that on a timescale of centuries, carbon these trees sequester may not stay there long. It doesn't mean the carbon sink of forests will go away, just that we may not have as much as we thought, says Pep Candle, the CSIRO Climate Science Centre in Australia. Okay. Really brief. Bulldogs' genetic breathing problems. Many English and French bulldogs developed breathing difficulties, and the flat face of those breeds were long thought to be responsible for this. Now it seems a mutation in the gene called ADAMTS3 may also play a role. In humans, the mutation is associated with fluorescent attention and swelling. A bit wise. Rise in colon cancer under the under 50s. Colorectal cancer seems to be becoming more common among younger people in richer countries. While these cancers are declining in older people, colon cancers in people under 50 rose by 1.8% between 1995 and 2014. Our long split from the Neanderthals. By comparing the teeth of ancient hominid, researchers have concluded that we have split from the Neanderthals earlier than we thought. Their analysis suggests that we last shared a common ancestor 800,000 years ago. It'd be nice if they actually said, Somi gave a data on that. Why should MMR be made obligatory? So measles, mumps, and rubella, I think, would be. I wonder what rubella... Okay, the UK should consider measles vaccinations compulsory before children start school, according to researchers in Italy. Okay. Their analysis is suggesting the current policies aren't enough to keep the virus under control. Vaccinations in the UK, US and Australia and Ireland were made with, among those examined. They concluded that the further action is needed in these countries and others to avoid the risk of losing the benefits of herd immunity. So this is if you immunise 90%, you get close to 100%. If you immunise 80%, you get close to 80%. either far more people need to be vaccinated or a school's policy be brought in that says the team. In analysis, it found that an estimated 3.7% of the UK population across all ages was susceptible to measles in 2018. Without a change to vaccination policies, it could rise to more than 5.5 by 2050, making outbreaks of measles more likely. But compulsory vaccination below school age on top of current routine immunisation schemes would enable the UK, Ireland and the US to ensure herd immunity in the decades ahead, which says a team member, Stefano Mueller and Bruno Kessler Foundation in Toronto. However, there were calls for new approaches for to be tried first. Making vaccination mandatory might have an unintended consequence, said Sonia Saxner of the Imperial College London. It risks disenfranchising parents and carers, as well as risking a rise in unvaccinated children being excluded from school, which would carry a stigma for children of parents who do not comply. My dear, I don't think that's a really good argument. Sounds good. A phone app to pick up an ear infection. I don't know. I wonder how that goes. And this is by Donna Liu. An app diagnoses ear infections in children by emitting a soft chirp and listening to the way it flicks back. To work, all it requires is a smartphone and a paper funnel. Oh yeah, that could be it. Developed by Justin Chan of the University of Seattle and his team, software plays a short sound through a paper funnel which is placed in the ear canal. Both acute and chronic middle ear infections cause fluid to build up behind the eardrum, and the sounds would normally have perforated the eardrum are reflected back through your canal. That's good if you can't hear it, it feels a bit dulled. Especially with children, because they can't tell you. Tested on 53 children aged between 18 months and 70 years, the app determined the likelihood of fluid being present with an accuracy of 85%, which is comparable to medical tools in a specialist clinic. That's really not enough data for me. The app includes a funnel which can be traced on paper and from the phone screen. Ear infections are common in childhood, but can be hard to diagnose in young children. They may tug on the ears and only have vague symptoms such as fever. Team hopes that the original approval for the app in the US Food and Drug Administration this year, the use of a medical tool before releasing it to the general public. Well, you'd want to, wouldn't you? Glue to mend a broken heart. A sticky material can repair cuts in pig hearts without using any stitches, then biodegrade. Hugo Okchak Chang of the University of China and his colleagues use polymers and water to create a glue that mimics the composition of viscous gel of proteins that help with the wound repairing elements. Once activated by UV light, the glue reacts with proteins and tissues to form a tight chemical bond sticking closely to the surface and sealing the wound. Team tested the technique on four pigs. Three little pigs, four little pigs went out today. They punctured the left ventricle of each pig's heart with it using a needle. Then the ventricle is the bottom part, so the left is the big one. Left, what we consider as left is actually rear, so it'd be actually very hard to get to the left ventricle. In less than 30, the glue was applied to wounds followed by UV light. In less than 30 seconds, the bleeding stopped. The bonds are strong enough to withstand the blood pressure twice the normal levels. No current existing clinical products can stop cooperative heart bleeding so quickly and efficiently, said Owen. To test the gel's biodegradability, the team injected it under the skin of rats, and only 20% of the glue remained after 8 weeks, and no adverse reaction was observed. I don't know how that goes. You're not testing sheer, there's whole heaps of things. Okay, so this is a major article here, a psychology and article by Joshua Howgego. Polygraph machines remain, the truth about lie detectors. Polygraph machines remain in use despite reality being discredited. There are better alternatives. Germany The Jeremy Carl Show, which has been broadcast in the UK since 2005, was sacked ITV last week. It featured people with troubled relationships arguing in front of a live audience, often spiced up with additional lie detector tests. In an episode filmed recently but never broadcast, a guest failed such a test designed to find out if he had cheated on his fiancée. He was later found dead. The lie detector tests aren't exactly rare on TV. We can thank Carl's US predecessor, Jerry Springer, for cementing their popularity as they endure on the show like Love Island, another ITV program. But the reach goes wilder. In the Ukraine, evidence from lie detector tests, also known as polygraphs, is the news of in court, while in the US they are used as a part of the recruitment process for government jobs. Oh, God. The problem is that if you filter out someone who can get past the lie detector test, that's frightening. Okay. It's all rather worrying, as lie detector tests don't live up to their name. They have long been discredited, while other methods of finding the truth are gaining ground. Quote, "It's good that the show has ended," said George Mash, an anti-polygraph campaigner based in the Netherlands. He says the program has contributed to the public mistakenly believing that a lie detector works or have any scientific basis. ITV didn't respond to questions about the use of lie detectors. Polygraph machines measure a person's pulse, blood pressure, and breathing while they answer a series of control questions. There's someone coming outside our house. I don't know if they're going to come in. Series of control questions like what they ate for breakfast or their age. Then the person asks a more pertinent question such as, did you cheat on your partner? If the vital signs leak, they are judged to be lying. But this is wrong. The factors being measured are designed to tally with a person's level of arousal, which you can think of as how alert you are. Being asked whether you are faithful to you is the sort of thing that would make you tense, whether you were or not. This isn't news. In the 1980s, psychologist David Leakin wrote about the lack of evidence that polygraphs could detect lies. He found that several studies claiming that they had an accuracy of 70% or more were poorly designed and showed no such thing. In 2003, the US National Academy of Sciences switched the same view. Manchk knows this all too well. In 1975, he applied for work at the RBA as an intelligence officer but failed the polygraph and was refused. I couldn't understand why I failed until I read everything on polygraphs and discovered that they are nonsense. Back in 1959, Leakin had an idea of a better method known as the concealed information test. It tries to determine whether or not a person is lying, but whether they have a memory of information being presented to them. For instance, the examiner might ask, where did the thief hide what he stole? Repeat the possibilities after me. Was it in the bathroom, in the locker, on the coat rack, on the windowsill? The person's skin conductance is measured during these questions. If it spikes during one of them, it suggests they are sweating more, and the options is meaningful to them. Okay. So that's a concealed question. All right. It's pretty amazing. Okay. And I do have people lie and stuff like that. This is different from polygraph because all the options are part of the same overall question. If a person says to have no knowledge of the crime, but the test indicates they do, you can infer they're probably lying. It has been used for years by police in Japan to help detect inquiries, direct inquiries at early stages of investigation. All the CIT tests rest on solid foundations. It isn't perfect memory detector. In 2014, meta-analysis of about 100 studies of CIT, concealed information tests, uncovered significant differences between results of people with guilty knowledge and without it. Yet, at best, a person who does have such a memory would be about 90% more likely to get a higher skin conductance reading than someone who doesn't. That might sound hard, but a test with that success rate is likely to produce false negatives. results suggesting people don't have knowledge when they actually do. Linda Gibbon, a legal psychologist at the University of Amsterdam, Netherlands, says this shows why CRT shouldn't be relied on in court as a sole proof of guilt. You would use it more in the investigation stage, she says. For example, to work out if police should look at one suspect more closely than others. Even then, CRT does detect, may not always be relevant. Memory trace, as Griffin calls them, for example, interviewees might recognize a suspect from a news report, even when they don't really know them. She is researching whether asking more specific questions could get around this. More recently, it has emerged that the CRT may reveal not just whether people have a memory of a detail, but whether they are deliberately covering it up. Nathaniel Klein-Stell of Hebrew University in Jerusalem in Israel found that although increased skin conductance does reveal the presence of that memory, heart rate and breathing only change when the person is trying to conceal it. This might sound like a polygraph, but is more reliable because the test aims to avoid inducing stress, but only presenting interviews with plausible answers. Researchers are also exploring whether other outward clues to improve CRT, including how people's eye move as they look at photos and faces. Psychologist Alicia Middleton at the University of Stirling in the UK has shown the way our eyes fixate on parts of a face differ when we recognise a face. The effect is stronger for faces we know best, such as a close friend. Milne is now working on a project to develop this test, potentially for use by the UK police. But many unknowns must be first resolved, including whether the test works equally well when the people from one or more culture look at the faces from another. Milne is currently studying whether people can conceal their recognition of faces, all of which means there is little excuse for still using polygraphs, whether on TV or elsewhere. For his part, Majish is campaigning for them to be dropped. Like Carl shows himself, our focus on public education, he says, for policy reform to happen, more people have to be understanding why lie detectors are not reliable. I say, Bitcoin's still going up. Pretty amazing. Okay. No machine needed how language gives away lies. And what a huge waste of your life. It's sort of like, it's like a bad investment. Quote, I'm always intrigued by what lie detection methods using equipment are so popular, says social psychologist Aldert Vigia at the University of Portsmouth, UK. To me, lies can be detected through using proper interview styles and analysing speech. Vergy argues that methods of detecting lies based on specific responses show the best results. These techniques assume that liars inevitably include fewer details when they ask questions than people telling the truth. Interviews focus on gathering information, starting with open questions, then probing more detail. For instance, you might ask a person at a border crossing about their highest qualifications, then name their school headmaster. One criticism is the method that is often tested in engineered situations where the stakes of the liars are lower than they would be in real life, meaning they might not try to be so convincing. But in a 2015 experiment, Thomas Olmert at the University of Sussex, Caldano, now at the University of Westminster, both the UK, asked around 200 people to pose as a passenger and lie at airport security, a far more realistic scenario. These individuals passed through border control along with the real passengers. Officers were asked to use either questioning technique or the method that looks for behavioural signs of nervousness. The questioners correctly identified 66% of the lying passengers, whereas those looking for behavioural signs caught only 5%. Which could well be, it's how many false ones they call, which is pretty amazing. Okay, this is BAE Systems. The emergency of threats from disruptive technology. Sounds as though it could be good, I suppose. So this is an info. This is actually not an article, it's an advertising feature. New technologies have always influenced the delicate balance of power between nations, people within them. Last month, new scientists gathered a group of defence experts to discuss how directive technologies are creating a new set of threats for society. The UK's most senior military officer recently set out the dangers of emerging in the 21st century. The threats to our nations are diversifying, proliferating and intensifying rapidly, says General Nick Carter, Chief of Defence and Staff. The character of politics and warfare is evolving rapidly, driven by pervasiveness of information and a rate of technological change. These technologies include artificial intelligence, robotics, new materials, information technologies. These sophisticated advances improve lives, but they also are open to exploitation. The more we depend on them, the more vulnerable we become. And that was the big implications for our defence. Quote, our competitors have become masters of exploiting the seams between peace and war, says Carter. Information technologies are a particular threat. Cyber attacks result in losses of $400 billion to the global economy every year. The UK government has warned that physical infrastructure such as power grids and transport systems are exposed as online systems to such actions. Earlier this month, New Scientist, in association with the BAE Systems, held a televised debate with a panel of experts in front of a handpicked studio audience to discuss the important issues, the threats that new technologies pose to our way of life, and how we might defend ourselves from them. On the panel were David Palmer, Director of Technology at Darktrace, a global AI company specialising in cyber defence, Katrina Kishan, Deputy Director of the National Security Science and Research at the UK Department of Transport, David Scott, Director of the Technology at BAE Systems, Trevor Taylor, who heads a research programme on defence and industry society at the Royal United Services Institute in London. All the panellists agree that the perils in the digital age are dramatically different to those 20 years ago. One reason is that we spend so much of our time online and we are highly dependent on interconnected autonomous systems for our energy, transport, communication and other needs. Another is that cyber weapons are relatively cheap, which makes it possible for anyone with sufficient motivation to know how to cause far-reaching damage. Quote, to produce a tank or a military aircraft or a nuclear weapon is highly complex and takes a lot of effort, skills and state apparatus, says Short. But a cyber environment, a small group, could potentially have just as potent impact as any sort of bomb. One area in which technology change has ushered in new players is the space industry. Here, private companies, even individuals, are competing in the field that used to be exclusive domain of rich governments. 21 out of the 34 rockets that entered orbits from the US in 2018 were launched by Elon Musk's company, SpaceX. As Taylor pointed out, the cost per weight of sending things up into space hasn't decreased drastically, but smaller electronic packages allows companies to use smaller satellites and rockets. Ah, oh, there you go. Yeah. Lessons from history. Commercial innovation inevitably carries a security risk. Quote, one thing we've seen over the history is that private industry likes to get things out in the market as soon as possible. So I'm just checking the time. And security is almost an afterthought, said Palmer. It would be a mistake, he added, to assume that because something is orbiting the Earth or has a unique design that it can't be hacked. That's not true. Sadly, we normally only get progress on these issues when there's a big failure. A lot of technological disruption is caused not by deliberate sabotage by rogue states or disgruntled individuals, but by software errors. As computer programs have become increasingly sophisticated, errors can be very hard to spot. Most software is now beyond the point of human comprehension, and Palmer said, in my field, we say that every 30,000 lines of code will have at least one major bug in it. He pointed to the Heartbleed bug discovered in 2014, an encryption library used by an estimated 500,000 secure web servers, including the online banks and tax agency. Software errors like these costed global economy $1.1 trillion in 2016. Heartbleed and WannaCry aside, digital technologies actually have more disruptive influences on our everyday lives when they work normally as when they go wrong. The popularity of platforms such as Facebook and YouTube and the speed at which their information disseminates through online social networks has allowed propaganda and fake news to flourish as never before. An investigation by the Oxford Internet Institute found evidence of formally organised social media manipulation in 48 countries in 2018 compared to 28 in 2017. As Taylor quipped, it's an old cliché that the first casualty of war is truth. In an age of hyper-influence, how can we prevent ourselves from being led astray? Kishan, whose sector, transport, is particularly vulnerable to real-world network effects, such as overcrowding, is guided by the principle derived from her training as a scientist. I always taught not to rely on a single measure. Always confirm, question, challenge, look for cooperation. That skill we all need to learn in today's society. She has a scientific approach to dealing with cybersecurity threats. We need to make secure our technology secure and to come through rigorous testing. Ultimately, the most effective solutions to many of our problems thrown up by digital technologies may be social rather than technical. I don't feel that we can get to where we want to by just building smarter technological defences, said Parham. At some point, we have to have some sort of society engagement. It sounds like a real wank fix to me. Okay, question of diplomacy. Political leadership can change the landscape of cybersecurity. In 2015, US President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping signed a bilateral agreement to reduce cyber espionage between the two countries. David Palmer from Darktrace said the result of this agreement, the number of hacking incidents US companies declined dramatically, which was a huge win, but there was an unintended consequence too. The share prices of cybersecurity companies fell due to the drop in business. The evidence shows how diplomacy can play a big role in reducing the grey zone beneath the threshold of conventional war. More recently, fake news and misinformation have become part of the battleground between nation states, whether a similar approach to the one taken in the US and China could help tackle these issues is still an open question. Go on, Barack. Okay. Okay, this is by Deborah McKenzie. Petition mentality. Populist gains in European elections are a problem for the planet, but campaigners must heed the concerns. This week, 28 countries vote to elect representatives in the European Parliament for the next 5 years. The UK only came to the ballot box kicking and screaming, having voted to leave 3 years ago. By the time you've read this, the results may well be in, and it's a safe bet that the wave of anger have propelled the populist anti-establishment parties to gains across the swathes of the continent. The problem is, for the planet, some of the parties hold views of climate change that make Donald Trump look like a well-informed moderate. France's National Rally, for example, supports the solar and wind energy fabricated in France as a way of reducing foreign imports, but denounces the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change as a communist project. The Alternative for Germany, AfD, party has government suppress the truth that carbon dioxide is a fertiliser, not a pollutant. Nigel Farage, leader of the Brexit Party, currently running hard in the UK poll, has repeatedly questioned the basics of climate science. This matters. The measures needed to combat climate change affect competition in a single market. Therefore, much of what the European countries are doing, creating the world's biggest carbon trading scheme, setting binding energy targets for efficiency, is coordinated by the EU level. To meet Paris Climate Change Agreement targets, the European Commission has ambitious plans. Carbon neutrality by 2040, measures of taking up to 40% of the EU budget. All of these, the European Parliament approval, so populists could significantly dilute Europe's efforts for climate change. Populists have gained traction in recent years by appealing emotionally to people who feel that their leaders are disregarding threats to their identity and stability of established communities from migration, globalisation, economic injustice, and changing social norms. Climate scientists in process movements such as Extinction Rebellion may still feel they are fighting the good fight against the elite reluctant to act on their concerns, but this is not how they are perceived by the large chunk of fellow scientists, citizens. Scientists are a remote elite, if ever there was one, with their suspicious allegiance to facts above group identities. Activists' advocacy of higher environmental taxes and restrictions on consumptions is viewed as harmful for ordinary people. Witness France's Gilets Jaunes project, sworn by opposition to high fuel tax. So this is yellow jackets, I suppose. It doesn't have to be this way. Climate change is a threat to the stability of everyone. Arguments for actions need to be calibrated to emphasize this, acknowledging that power is not just of facts, but of emotions. That means talking not just economic costs and climate action, but also about less tangible impacts on the shared identity and heritage. This is a threat to much loved landscapes. Crucially, we need to show how the efforts to limit emissions can positively affect local communities. There's no umbilical link between populism and anti-climate positions. Hungary's ruling party, Fidesz, for example, is one of the three Euro-populist parties to accept climate science. Fanned by other winds, populism won't burn out soon, but it should consume climate action. That's beautifully written. Beautifully written there. Okay. And see how we go. No Planet B, no Plan B. And this is by Graham Lawton, staff writer for The New Scientist. Putting people in their place. Many controversial issues are moving out of the margin these days. But one we should take seriously is the growing population, says Graham Lawton. Well, I know you can do it. It's just, I really do hope he talks about Peak Baby. One of the occupational hazards of writing about the environment is readers criticising my failure to mention the P word. No, not polar bears or plastics, population. There's no environmental crisis, I'm told, that cannot be blamed on there being too many people or solved by, well, if you see the problem with the following line of argument. Last month, I spent a slightly weird Saturday afternoon at an annual gathering on pressure group Population Matters, the true believers of the population movement. They're passionate but rather eccentric discussions reminded me of former Prime Minister David Cameron's dismissal of the UK Independent Party as fruitcakes and loonies. Yes, he also called them closet racists. We'll get to that later. To be clear, I don't think the population activists are fruitcakes and loonies or racists. Decades of beating your heads against brick walls isn't enough to make anyone's eyes swivel. But like the UKIP, there are signs that their hobby horse is riding into the mainstream. Population was always a fringe issue in the 1960s and 70s. It was regarded as an urgent environmental problem, but gradually faded from view as the campaigners faced more socially acceptable problems such as overconsumption. Essentially, we've got to cut the consumption down. Eventually, the P word became taboo, tended by what has become population shame. The idea that any calls for population controls are hypocritical, racist, coercive, typically consisting of rich white people lecturing poor non-white people to have fewer children. Those same advocates consume rapidly while blaming environmental problems on population growth in the developing world, given that most of this growth, up to 2050, is projected to happen from Africa. You can see why accusations of racism and neo-colonialism strike a chord. Population activists deny this, pointing out that countries such as Bangladesh have radically decreased the fertility rates without coercion. They also make it clear that they regard Western overconsumption as part of the problem. Their goal, they say, is to empower people, especially women, to have smaller families. Nevertheless, mainstream green organisations have studiously avoided talking about population. At a conference, however, change was in the air. Population, I feel, is rising up the agenda, said Population Matters Director Robin Mayen. It's due finally to have a proper public discourse on policy action and merits. This just isn't wishful thinking. One cause of its optimism was the conservation of the World Wildlife Fund's official presence at the conference. At first, after decades of sidestepping the issue, the UK Director of Science, Mark Wright, endured a somewhat torrid afternoon, heckled by a crowd and the butt of frequent World Wildlife Federation bashing. But he kept his cool and made it clear the organisation now acknowledged population as part of the problem. I felt like this is the start of a genuine rapprochement. An even bigger factor is that David Attenborough, every episode of his new Netflix series, Our Planet, made in collaboration with World Wildlife Fund,
begins with saying, just 50 years ago, we finally ventured to the moon. Since then, the human population has more than doubled. Then Attenborough speaks, people listen. Consider the impact of Planet 2 had on the awareness of plastics. Scientists also are challenging the taboo. The Matsu report on the intergovernmental science policy on biodiversity and ecosystem services made headlines for the dire warnings about the declining populations of wild species. What went largely unnoticed was the frequency reference to human population as a driver. The next hurdle to get the population on the global agenda. The first opportunity next year when the Convention on Biological Diversity is up for renewal. Maynard and others are campaigning to have population acknowledged as a problem and perhaps even included as an official target. They are also calling for the UN Framework Convention on Population, like the climate one. They can expect a pushback. The forces of reaction are strong, as shown the vicious media attacks on Greta Thunberg's Extinction Rebellion. Population activists will be called fruitcakes, loonies, and closet racists, but they can console themselves that UKIP eventually forced the referendum in wonder. Don't get me wrong, I'm no fan of UKIP, but I am a fan of Denialists finally seeing the light. You know what? I think the main thing you have to point out is Pete Baby. Who's that person? Hans and Olive Rolding or something like that. Okay, your letters and 55 minutes reading. Cause private plumbers take the lead on a fix from the 27th of April. As Adam Vaughan writes in his now, it is now clear that we have to reduce our greenhouse gases emissions to zero. But the question of when depends on who we mean by we. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change special report shows that global emissions should reach net zero by 2050. But that doesn't mean that the US, UK and other developed nations should set 2050 as a target date. These countries have contributed far more than others their fair share to climate change. The principle of global equity that enshrined in the Paris Agreement on climate change requires that those who have caused the problem should take the lead in solving it. The means developed, that means developed nations should reduce their emissions to net zero before 2050. In the UK, only Extinction Rebellion and the Green Party have a target dates of 2025 and 2030 respectively, have faced up to this. The origins of language, oh dear, and what was it? It was singing at night to get away predators is important. From Carolyn Windham's, watching people, in particular young children, concentrating on using their hands for fine motor skills while sticking out their tongue, lends credence to the possibility that language began with hand movements. I wonder whether speech developed as our ancestors began to live in groups, with some members going to hunt and the rest making clothing and fashioning tools. This home-based activities could have loosened the tongues as the hand worked and enabled tongues automatically evolve into speech. Another thing by Alex Cleland, Wessex, Yorkshire. Since gathering, rather than hunting, provided the majority of calories for the early communities, why is such a focus on the origin of language placed on suggestions of what may have aided our ancestors to hunt rather than to gather? Some propose seeing equal reflection as the origin of language. Maybe this started when the gatherers, probably mostly female, were foraging rather than just protection overnight. Information would need to be transmitted about which plants were safe and which areas could be explored on a daily basis, not just for sporadic hunts. I would agree with that. It's an interesting theme. Okay. How early humans could have reached Luzon Island? I can't remember reading this article. Where is Luzon Island? I don't know. If another human species have been discovered on the island of Luzon, now in the Philippines, how did it get there and when? There were five or six periods of low sea level into the mid-late Paleocene It's the two of the most recent of these levels were about 120 metres below the presence around 20,000 years ago, and 100 metres or lower around 65,000 years ago. This allowed someone to walk most of the way to Luzon from Malaysia or Flores via Borneo, Palawan and Pascua. The main obstacle would have been the Medora Strait. This narrow submarine canyon is much too deep to have been dry, but at this time it would have been only 65 kilometres wide. On a calm day, someone could have paddled across on a log. I would put my money on Homo luzonensis being a close relative of Homo floresus rather than having evolved an isolated species. Welcome to the new, even more bizarre masters. Your report on DeepMind's artificial intelligence was able to add up 7 is, and that it's concluded that 17 times 4 is 69. That's unusual. That's artificial stupidity. Until now, artificial stupidity was the responsibility of the human programmers. Now, the machine stupid is on its own. I predict further advances in artificial intelligence will yield even worse artificial stupidity. 4. Intelligence and stupidity are linked. When robots awake, they will make unusual mistakes. Apply precautionary principle to mobile safety. Chris Stalker-Walker says there is little evidence that banning Chinese company Huawei from supplying 5G mobile technology is the right approach. But when deciding this, we shouldn't be seeking evidence to test the hypothesis. We should use precautionary principle. Don't do something if it might be disastrous. The question is not whether Huawei has mishandled data in the past, it's whether it has done things in the Chinese state. It is whether the company can be trusted to do so, not in the future. I would agree. What's the motivation for the US trying to stop Huawei selling 5G networks to UK and others? There is a body of opinion that this is to get US companies to dominate the market and to enforce the spread of US spyware, not Chinese. The US National Security Agency has reported meddled with US-made devices that route data to all networks. The US would find it harder to put backdoors into kit from elsewhere. Backdoors have not been found in Huawei kits. Its coding standards are poor, but so, unfortunately, are those of others who sell their hardware. As you say, sensitive data should be encrypted, but this still leaves communications open to traffic analysis, tracking who talks to whom rather than what they talk about. Metadata. Let's see if I can read to the end of this before the light fades. Please choose to read this to try and fathom free will. What? Oh yeah, this is free will. I love arguing about this. Tom Stafford argues that the idea that free will doesn't exist is based on misguided intuitions of what it means to be a biological machine. Is it fair to assume that any scientific model of mechanisms of free will decisions should ultimately be expressible in mathematical form? I understand this to be the case for scientific models generally in mathematics, however, it appears only to have concepts of direct deterministic inference or randomness, no blend of which fits the bill of modelling free will. A scientific model of free will would appear to require the building of a model that takes identical inputs on each run, maintains no state between runs, uses no purely random sources, and yet produces results that are not fully predictable. Perhaps maths can't contain such a model. But what would science be without maths, or free will without science? This has been the driving me up the wall for the past 25 years since I got my master's in maths, specialising in quantum field theory, general relativity, and all mathematical physics goodness. I'm now training to be an Anglican priest, so all of this free will stuff is appearing again in a slightly different context. This is a bit weird. Stanford confuses complexity with freedom. He admits that our thoughts are caused by our brains, our environment, and our history. but to maintain that because the causal mix unique to each individual at each moment, human behaviour is so difficult to predict that the elevated above the danger above digger wasps. So digger wasps are one that they clean the tunnel. They move their program to clean the tunnel after they've moved the seed, their larvae to a certain area. And then what you do is, while they're cleaning, you move the larvae back. They do then move back and clean it forever, ever more. Okay. Hacking a car may not be an innocent foible. Okay. Chris Barrett concludes that it's one thing to hack an artificial intelligence controlling a vehicle in a car park, and quite another to hack an AI controlling a weapon. But what about a weapon such as the driverless car that is doing 50 kilometres per hour on a city street, for example? Single gene mutations may be detectable by smell. Discussing whether cystic fibrosis carriers might recognise each other, Richard Harris says, it seems extremely likely that one mutated gene among tens of thousands will be detectable by smell. But there are examples of this. For example, trimethylmuria, also known as fish odor syndrome, is caused by the mutation of such a gene. The body odor changes and the ARBC gene, which also controls the type of earwax you produce. Cystic fibrosis is caused by mutation that results in, among other things, a build-up of thick mucus on the lungs and the digestive system. It is inconceivable that lung infections caused by such a build-up could be detectable by odour. Up to date with magnetic units would be so much clearer. Well, there you go. Alongside Daniel Cost's interesting article on fast radio bursts, you describe competitive magnetic field strengths of various bodies, but sadly in non-SI units of gas. The Tesla is the modern SI unit, magnetic flux density. You show comparison of the field strengths of commercial magnets with neutron stars and megastars. These values would have been much clearer expressed in millitesla, or 100 megatesla, or 100 gigatesla, respectively. So I think 100 gas is a Tesla. Wet. In the class of space rocks of Ecuador that may have brought half of its water to the Earth, the oceans. Oh, yeah. So these are changes here. So I'm just going to read this. Goodbye to the Kilo by Leah Crane and finish off for the moment. That's an hour and 2 minutes reading. There's a new way to weigh. For over a century, the kilogram, defined by a metal cylinder in a French vault, platinum and iridium. Now, the key unit of mass is defined by using the Planck's constant, a fundamental figure for physics. Planck's constant relates, we've defined what the Planck's constant is numerically, and therefore docked in the, all we've done is that we're no longer measuring Planck's constants, we've locked it in as a number. And that's locked in the kilogram. This incredibly small number has to be determined using a sensitive Kibble balance pitched lift that uses powerful magnetic fields to do the work. Researchers, or you could do it with Lego. There's a Lego version of it. Researchers will now be able to weigh things accurately without flying to France to compare them to the cylinder, known as Le Grand K, for the international project kilogram pictured below. If it lost mass, perhaps being scratched or gained some through your fingerprints, says the definition of kilogram would alter. That's right. So what's happening is that all the kilograms around the world began gaining weight. And you think, oh, how's this? That's because it was losing weight for some reason. The French. By comparing Le Grand K with copies that are distributed globally, it was clear, despite efforts to protect the precious cylinders, the mass did change. Well, its mass didn't change, the actual quantity changes. At last, the kilogram would join French's science's other units of becoming universal and unchanging. It's not joining other units, we're just defining the speed of light, defining everything down, and not locking it to measurements. There you go. Just amazing that rather than measuring Planck's constants, we've now defined it. To the moon with love. Okay, there's a few more books here. What she is it? Culture. No, this is, oh my god, it's a lot more magazine to read, folks. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.